My name's Peter Manning. Just want to add here with Ali that he declaims the journalism thing, but actually he is a very distinguished columnist in the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. I don't know if people saw his column today
in the Sydney Morning
Herald. That's right, on the op-ed page, which was also reprinted in the Brisbane Times, which I think is an online paper of Fairfax here in Brisbane, and argues the case for Palestine, and in particular one state that includes Jewish and Palestinian people, which is the subject of the book, which will be on sale outside. So, just taking it from Heather, questions. Ali really, really enjoys questions and has done so just about all day today. So, and enjoys the discussion. So, if you've got any questions, please go for it.
Do you think that the citizens of Israel use this as an alternative media source?
We do have a readership in Israel. We publish in English, which means that primarily our readership are in English-speaking countries. 60% are in North America, and that's deliberate. We are sort of aiming outwards at the rest of the world, and not so much particularly at an audience in the Middle East itself. But we do have a readership in Israel. We do have contributors in Israel and Israeli contributors outside the country. And I think that's been one of the more fascinating things, that Israeli voices reach us that may not necessarily come to us through some of the mainstream media, which loves to simplify things into, Israelis think one thing and Palestinians think another, and obscures the diversity of opinion across those groups. So that's one of the things that I think we've been able to challenge as well.
Hi, I was just wondering if you could explain what's stopping more foreign journalists from going in and reporting from Palestine.
Nothing is stopping them. Although the Israelis do place restrictions, that there is military censorship in Israel, but they could go. I think that the problem affecting reporting in Palestine is, in a certain way, there's almost too much reporting from Palestine in this sense, that it's in the news sort of disproportionately for its size and population, as compared, say, to Africa, which gets relatively much less attention in Western media. But the quality of the content of it, it's not very enlightening. It's the same sort of storyline of, endless violence, and nobody really can understand why these people hate each other so much, and, everyone has their typecast role, and there's never really any sort of breaking of new ground. But I think, at least in the United States, and I don't know enough about Australia, there has been such a radical cutback of foreign reporting in general, and much less emphasis on that, much less expertise devoted to that, and so the rest of the world suffers, and what is now being privileged is, anything that's on video is news. So if a cat is stuck in a tree, it leads the news bulletins if somebody has video of it. And that's because it's cheap, it's because it gets ratings, but there's very little sort of active effort to say we're going to go out and cover the world. And journalists and editors complain about that all the time. They say that the corporations that own the papers now are just cutting back drastically. A question I'd ask Peter what he thinks about this, is what will the landscape look like in 10 years' time? Will newspapers as we know it still exist? Will television as we know it still exist? I think we're really in a moment of transition. And, it looks like we, you know, we were sort of incredibly forward-looking or something, because, you know, this is an independent effort and we're not reliant on, you know, on any major donors or anything. But it actually just was an organic thing that grew to fill a gap that was there, but I think a gap that is now widening across the board.
I haven't read the book, but the notion of one nation to me is reminiscent of the notion of the secular democratic state that was bandied around in the 1970s. The difficulty about this is one would have to assume some kind of a secular state. And I don't want to be a pessimist, but given that secularism is badly retreating in the Arab world, actually in fact is retreating in the West, given that, and given the history of animosities and what have you, and fundamentalism and what have you, the notion of one nation is very, 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 very idealistic. And I would gather that the Israelis will object to it much more, because in due course there will be demography-wise there'll be a minority in a large state.
Your question is good. We happen to publish, I don't know if this is today or yesterday, because I still haven't figured out the dateline thing. Because while I'm here, I'm still working on the electronic intifada, and so I have to operate in two date zones simultaneously. Anyway, May 12th, we published this op-ed by Selim Maqdisi, a professor at... this was originally in the LA Times, but a professor at UCLA, and I think he makes the case as well or better than I could, that it's really not so much a question of what you or I prefer as a solution. The reality is that there's not going to be a two-state solution. The reality on the ground is that there is no possibility of partition, that the notion of a Palestinian state is as unrealistic as any other solution, because there's no room for a Palestinian state. So the question really, and I would argue that already we have a single state, but it's an apartheid state. So really the question is not what do you prefer or what do I prefer or what do I think is more realistic or idealistic, but how do we deal with the reality of a single apartheid state? And I think inevitably, the what we're going to move towards is a struggle for equal rights for all the people who live in it. As far as the retreat of secularism, I think that's a worry. That's true. That's a challenge from all over the world. But I think in the Arab world, secularism has been given, in a sense, a bad name, because it was, in a way, associated with anti-religion. And I prefer to use the term non-sectarian. What we need is a non-sectarian state, not a state that is anti-religion or anti-religious, but a state that is separate from religion, and is also neutral among religious groups. And I don't see an alternative to that, because in a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country like Palestine, it would be madness to try to have a Jewish state. It would be madness to try to have a Christian state or a Muslim state, because that's simply going to antagonize the rest of the population and generate further conflict. And this is not a unique situation. I talk in the book about South Africa, where there were similar challenges, Northern Ireland, and other parts of the world. So is the hatred and the fundamentalism so great that we can't move towards that? I hope not. There have been situations where people were as pessimistic or more pessimistic, and they were able to move beyond it. And so I hope you would read the book, because I try to make that case. But I think it's becoming urgent that even if we think a one-state solution is impossible or unrealistic or even undesirable, we have to be aware that the two-state solution is no longer an option either.
Can I make a point?
Sure.
The more feasible one would have to be some kind of a federal state, not a unitarian state. This is the worry is about, I mean, with the federal state, that's probably more feasible. But to think of a unitarian sort of state, as I said, I was much more optimistic about this in the late 60s. I was in the Friends of Palestine movement in the 1970s, and we did a lot of work on Palestine. But as time went on, you sort of you are encountering more pessimism, especially with the rise of sectarianism and fundamentalism on both sides, Muslim and Jewish. Yeah. And the debate in the late 60s, the way we used to run the debate here, it was a secular debate. It's a debate about a contested territory between two groups of people. But since then, it has been couched in religious terms, in theological terms, as Said would say.
Yes, I think that that's true to an extent, but I don't think it's as hopeless as you think it is. I think even Hamas, which is held up as being this sort of the poster boy for Islamism or fundamentalism, is actually a lot more flexible and pragmatic, and many of its leaders are a lot more open-minded on these questions than they're given credit for. And are actively debating amongst themselves and writing to the outside world and speaking about, how do we square our own ideology and view of the world with the reality of a multi-ethnic state. So they're the ones talking about coexistence with Israel, while Israel is saying, no, we will never talk to Hamas. So they're actually, I think, in a sense, much more open to this. And that's, considered the most extreme segment of Palestinian opinion. I think Israelis will not agree to any solution that requires them to give up their powers and privileges willingly, any more than whites in South Africa or in the southern states of the United States before the civil rights movement. It's going to be as a result of pressure and as a result of their seeing a greater benefit to change than to the status quo. But I think the task for us is to begin to develop a vision that can begin to appeal to Israelis who say, okay, I understand that the current system of apartheid is unjust and untenable. What's the alternative? We have to start to talk about the alternatives. And we are only at the beginning of that discussion, and there are a lot of obstacles to it. And whether it's a federal state or a confederal state or what kind of state, that's a discussion we have only just begun.
Can I just ask, Ali, you passed over, I think because you said this three times already today in other lectures, why do you feel that the two-state solution has passed out of history?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that simply there's no possibility of an agreed partition. And that's been the case from the beginning. The first proposals for partition of Palestine came from the British, from the Peel Commission in 1937. And what the Peel Commission said is, look, we've got two groups of people, they all want to live together, here's a great idea, let's separate them into separate states. The only problem is, there's no way to do that. There's no way to draw a line between them. So the Peel Commission explicitly said, we will have to have the transfer, voluntary or otherwise, of a significant portion of the Arab population. In other words, from the beginning, partition was inextricably linked with ethnic cleansing. And today is the same. There could not be a partition of Palestine without ratifying ethnic cleansing by saying the refugees who are kicked out of their homes can't return, or by forcing more Palestinians out of certain areas. And the demographics are that, today, under the rule of the Israeli government, less than half the population is Jewish. Today in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, only 48% of the population is Jewish. So how can you have a Jewish state under those circumstances? Within the 1948 borders of Israel, 20% of the population is not Jewish. And they don't want to live in a state that gives special privileges only to Jews. So there's no way, I think, you can do a partition. The settlements on the ground have, you know, the population distribution is such that it's not possible. And realistically, Ehud Olmert said it in November, that we're reaching the point where the Palestinians may well begin a struggle for equal rights, and when that happens, he said it, Israel is finished. So what he's admitting to us is that Israel as we know it depends on there being institutionalized inequality between people, and that Israel cannot survive equal rights. What you call the single state in the end, I don't care. It can be called Israel, it can be called Palestine, it can be called whatever you want. But as long as all the people in it have equality, that's the fundamental principle that's at stake. And I think the direction we're heading towards in everything.
Just going back to your website, do you have any plans or any efforts to encourage war readership within Israel and the surrounding region of your website?
We don't have any plans. I think that if we were going to seriously do that, we'd have to start publishing in Hebrew and in Arabic, and I think that's simply beyond our capacity to do right now, but I would love to do it at some point. You know, we've talked about sort of partnering with Arab independent publications to sort of exchange material and to translate and do that kind of thing, but we've only talked about it at this stage. But it hasn't been a priority because we think that there are good sources for people who want to read about these issues in Arabic. You know, actually, in the Hebrew press, there is some more diversity of opinion. But, you know, the gap that we have the mission to sort of fill is what's available in the English language and to audiences in North America, Europe, Australia, and, you know, the general English-speaking audience. I just say that is obviously a very Euro and American-centric view of the world, and that's not adequate in a world where power and influence is shifting to other parts of the world, and particularly to Asia. So, you know, I think it does pose a serious challenge for us to think about how we begin to address audiences more broad than the ones we're used to dealing with.
I just wanted to go back to a media issue you raised earlier. I was interested that you voiced your malaise about the huge rise in blogging and as opposed to the decline in newspaper sales and so on around the world. And I share that malaise in terms of what you said, you know, what the concerns about a world where there are 50 million op-ed columnists and hardly any reporters on the worldwide information page. Do you have an answer for that? Is the answer to not go blog-wise with your sort of site, but to go for a newspaper online, more specifically devoted to reporting, because there's a great lack of in-depth reportage, as we know. And on an issue like this, it so often comes down to one opinion versus the other, as opposed to that closely argued detail, which is quite compelling, and which you pointed out you've done quite a bit of on this site. So I just wondered if you could comment on the options and the future in terms of that problem.
Well, I don't have the answer, but I think what we're doing is one answer, in that this is an independent publication. We are committed to reporting and analysis. About 50% of what we publish is completely original material, and about 50% is republished. A lot of it is you know, material taken from various reputable sources and human rights organizations, that sort of thing, or the kind of reporting that they showed you that we're doing from Gaza.
And, you know, we are largely reader supported. We are supported through through this button here. And this is not entirely. We managed to get a little bit of institutional support from Europe, but not from within the United States. We failed miserably to do that, not for want of trying. But I think that so this is an example of an independent, non-profit publication. And I would say we are, you know, basically an online newspaper. We do all the things that, you know, we would like to think a good newspaper does. I think the non-profit investigative journalism model is one that attracts me. I think what other people are trying to figure out is how to make real reporting make money as a for-profit thing, and I'm just not good at that. I don't know how to do it. It's just not something I know how to do. And we haven't taken advertising. I don't know if something like this would be sustainable through advertising. We haven't really explored it seriously, and I think I like the idea of being a public service and being accountable to a readership rather than worrying about what advertisers think. But maybe that's sort of a position we won't be able to afford to have forever.
I know you were talking more about the Western media, in particular American media and stuff. So I'm not sure how you can answer this question, but I'll ask anyway. What do you think of the Arab media and their point of view in Israel-Palestine conflict? Do you think they're too pro-Palestinian, or do you think they're more balanced than the Western media?
It depends. It's like everything else. There's good Arabic language media and bad Arabic language media. There's a lot of really worthless state-controlled broadcasters or state-controlled newspapers that are absolutely shoddy. And there is, a panoply of particularly television and satellite journalism that I think has had a hugely beneficial effect in terms of reporting. And I think that by and large, you know, some of them are doing a very good job. Al Jazeera is the most famous. I wouldn't say that all its reporting is fantastic, just like any other organization. But on the whole, I think they get the story right because they are asking different questions. You know, they're asking questions which come from a different sensibility. That doesn't make them unbalanced or biased. It means that the answer you get depends on the question you ask. And I think Western media, by and large, have asked a different set of questions and therefore have gotten a different set of answers. And I think we need to be asking all those questions. So I don't think you can say, you know, one is more balanced or one is more objective. And I think it's in a sense, a futile. I think you can be factual and you can be accountable that what you say someone else can go and verify by looking at, you know, how you've come to say it. But I don't think that there is one truth in that sense that is sort of the ideal balanced or objective report.
I just have one question because I was just reading the book about the case for, the Israel lobby, and the professors were saying that the Israel lobby was really very powerful. So, I mean, the kind of work that Electronic Intifada or bloggers do in Palestine might raise certain issues, but back in the corridors of power in Washington itself, if you look at the major presidential candidates, none of them have a different stand towards this issue. So, what's your opinion on that? Because, I mean, I mean, you can do a lot of grassroots journalism, but at the end of the day, if, you know...
Yes, that you're referring to the book, The Israel Lobby by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. And that just reminded me. This is actually the most read article in the history of the Electronic Intifada, according to the statistics we have. And it's from more than a year ago. And it's circulated very widely. It has been quoted in the New York Times and all over the place. And was, you know, has been quite sort of controversial. The point there is, and here's one of the reasons, Barack Obama and Edward Said. So this has sort of generated a lot of debate about what Barack Obama's true opinions are on the Israel-Palestine conflict. So. You know, I'm not trying to say we've had any influence at all on the presidential election or debate, but we actually, you know, may have a tiny footnote to a footnote in the history of the 2008 election with this article. But yes, we are mostly, you know, if people were listening to us or if we had access to the corridors of power, we'd be running the newspapers and the TV stations. And to our journalist friends and colleagues here, but I think that at least in the United States, we have very little access to the mainstream media, and therefore a very little access to the mainstream political debate. So we're realistic about the limits of our influence, but you know, the question I would ask is, you know, does that mean we shouldn't bother at all? And I feel like we've had enough of an impact that we continue to do that. I feel like I've sort of drifted away from the question about the Israel lobby, so let me address that. I think the Walt Mearsheimer thesis is an attractive one to a lot of people because it provides a very simple explanation for why it's so hard to get a hearing for a Palestinian viewpoint. And there's a lot of truth to it in the sense that there are powerful pro-Israel organizations that come down like a ton of bricks on, you know, people or organizations that stray from a certain line. But, and I've certainly experienced that personally. And you can find all sorts of nasty things said about me in the Electronic Intifada and others. But there's, I don't think there's such a thing as an Israel lobby that has an absolute veto. And it's important not to exaggerate the influence that it has, because if we do, then we disempower ourselves. We put ourselves in a position where we say, well, there's no point bothering because you know, nothing can be done, because there's someone who can always sort of pull the plug on us. And the reality is that I don't think that's the case. The other thing is that there is, I think, a big difference now in the United States between sort of the discourse that's going on in presidential politics, which is very narrow and very limited, and what's happening more broadly in society, where the Walt Mearsheimer book is in fact is a symptom or a really a product of a more broad willingness to question the role of Israel in US politics, to question the US-Israeli alliance, to look at the whole range of U.S. relationships and interventions in the Middle East. This is partly an outcome of the Iraq war, where people are saying, you know, everything we were told was a lie. And it's a debate that's happening, I think, more broadly than is reflected in the mainstream media and than is reflected in the mainstream political discourse. But I do think that eventually it will start to make its way upwards.
Two more questions, then we'd better halt, I think.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a quick question as to what kind of an impact the completion of the apartheid wall may have had on freedom of movement for journalists, be they Palestinian, Israeli or international.
Well, there's been a tremendous impact on independent journalists because Israel is very actively deporting or refusing entry to a lot of independent journalists and filmmakers and others. I think that they don't really yet dare to do that to, you know, someone from a big network because it would attract attention. But they are doing it a lot to independent journalists, and I think there are sort of more subtle ways of putting pressure. You know, there are cases where I've heard, you know, it's sort of hard to prove where this or that BBC or other journalist has been withdrawn because the Israelis are unhappy with them. Those are stories I hear. I'm not making that claim, but people have said that kind of thing to me. So yes, I think for independent journalists it's a challenge. And personally, some of the independent journalists we work with, the Electronic Intifada, have been refused entry or have been refused renewal of their visas in recent years. But we find ways around it.
Yep, sure.
Yes.
You mentioned that there was that the Palestinian struggle for equal rights would be the beginning of the end for the conflict. And I was just wondering if you had a timeline or a belief of how far away that would be, if it's you say it was inevitable or it's going to happen. What would be a catalyst for it as well? Would there be one event that would be a catalyst that you can see in the future?
It's hard to predict, but I have been saying for a couple of years that I think I said about 4 years ago that within about 3 to 5 years there would be a widespread recognition that the two-state solution is no longer viable. And I think we're reaching that point. We are at a moment where that recognition is starting to sink in, but there's still a lot of resistance to the idea. And most people cannot imagine what comes next. They're clinging on to the idea because they can't imagine, you know, any other kind of solution. It just becomes sort of a very comforting idea that one day there'll be a two-state solution. But I think that there is a possibility. You know, people often sometimes say, oh, well, you know, this idea sounds very nice, but it would take 100 years. I can't say it won't take 100 years, but I think there's a very good possibility that things could change much more rapidly than we expect. And, you know, history is full of cases like that. I think a lot of people, I remember that a few years ago, Farid Ishaq, one of the veteran anti-apartheid campaigners from South Africa, came to Chicago, and he was asked this question. He was talking about Palestine, and he was asked, well, you know, that the Palestinians are up against so much, you know, isn't it futile? And he said something that really stuck with me. He said, you know, I don't think there was a moment when myself and my colleagues were engaged in the struggle against the apartheid government that we ever thought we could win. But that's not why we did it. We did it because there was no alternative, but, you know, without struggling, we would surrender our dignity. So that's one case. I you know, all the experts and all the think tanks in the world and all the Kremlinologists and centers of Soviet studies did not predict the end of the Soviet Union or the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I was in Ireland last year when the power-sharing government was implemented, and it was amazing that a lot of people could not believe that power-sharing would happen until they saw the television images of Ian Paisley and Gerry Adams sitting next to each other. So all I'm saying is I can't predict, but we should also not put ourselves in a situation where we believe change is impossible or change is unlikely or so remote. I think the possibility of great change, especially when things are as fluid as they are now, is real.
Okay, well, that's the end of tonight. I hope you've enjoyed Ali Abanima, and give him a thanks.